everyone, and welcome to this very special Halloween spooky season episode of Mental Health Much with no other than AJ from the Crime Family Podcast. Hello, AJ.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you on my podcast. I've been wanting to explore the true crime world for a while, and somebody directed me at your podcast, and I discovered your podcast, and I was like, I need the people from Crime Family on my show.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit, I think, like before the summer and stuff, and we kind of had something in the works that we were going to do a collab at some point. So I'm glad it's finally here.
Yeah, just in time for Halloween.
Yeah, exactly.
So AJ, for people who don't know you or your podcast, tell us a little bit more about what you do and what is your podcast?
Yeah, so my podcast, it's Crime Family. So it's me and my two sisters. Every episode, we kind of talk about a new true crime case. Some are really well-known ones that like most people would know. Others are pretty unknown ones that you probably have never heard of. We try to do, you know, a good variety. And yeah, so we just each take turns kind of narrating. So each episode, sometimes I'll be narrating the case. Other times it's my other sister. So we kind of go back and forth and just kind of dissect the case and talk about it. So yeah, it's really fun.
So you're starting season 3, if I'm not wrong.
Season 4.
You're starting season 4. You just finished season 3.
Yes. So we're actually just started recording for season 4 last week. So we're just in the very early stages of season 4. So still very much in the planning mode and trying to research cases and stuff.
I'm not like the best true crime fan, but I think there are like two different types. There are ones where people discuss crimes that have kind of been solved or like most of the information is already out. And I think there are true crime podcasts where people are almost like being journalist or detective at the same time and trying to solve them like IRL, like while they're happening. Am I right?
Yes. So the true crime podcast field is very saturated. So there's so many different kinds of true crime shows. I've come across a few that are kind of like comedy shows where they talk about true crime, which is kind of weird. And then other ones are, much more investigative. And then others are just kind of talking about cases that are solved and stuff like that. So we kind of do a mixture. We do some that are solved or some that are cold cases that are still ongoing. So we try to mix it up. At first, with the first season, when we first started, our show was going to be just about crimes that happened with like people who knew each other. So it'd be like loved ones who kill each other or something like that.
Okay.
Kind of going with the crime family name. But then we found that it was very limiting because we would find cases that were super interesting and really important, but they didn't fall into that category. So for the first season, we stuck pretty close to it. But then after starting with season 2, we branched out a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So it's been much better that way because much more cases that we can cover.
So I personally find it really hard to listen to true crime stuff. And I have to admit, I don't fully understand the vibe. That's why I really wanted to have someone who loves it to talk about it on my show and kind of understand it as a mental health professional. So I haven't listened to all of your episodes because I have to limit myself. But I think you alluded at sometime doing interviews with some of the victims' family or people on the case. Have you been doing that on your show?
Yeah, well, so starting with season 2, we started to have guests. And it's honestly been very challenging to find, you know, enough or a lot of cases where we can reach out to family members where we would feel comfortable reaching out to them to come on the show. So we haven't done that a lot, but season 2, we did have a really good guest. He was wrongfully imprisoned for 16 years for a murder that he didn't commit. So he was pretty young and they arrested him and he was in jail for 16 years and then they found the real killer. So then he was exonerated. So we actually had him on the show. I really enjoyed that interview with him. And then we also had someone on the show who was doing a documentary film about his case. So we were able to talk to her as well and talk about, you know, her experience working with Jeff and all of that stuff. And another guest that we had, she used to be in law enforcement, but she did a lot of work in domestic violence. So we had her on for a domestic violence awareness episode talking about warning signs and stuff like that. So that was really interesting as well. So we've had guests a little bit, okay. but not a ton of guests.
Yeah, I can see how it would be tricky. So I've been honest that it's not my genre. And I really want to have like a really meta conversation about the true crime world. Mm-hmm. But before we go into why people are fascinated by it, what decided you and your sisters to start this project?
So there's actually four of us, four siblings altogether.
Oh, no, and one was left behind?
Yeah, well, she had the chance. She could have done it, but she didn't commit to it. But yeah, it was Katie who messaged our group chat. I think this would have been probably January of 2021. And she was just like, we should do a true crime podcast. And it was interesting because for a couple of years before that, I had wanted to start a podcast, but I didn't know who I would start it with, if I would do it by myself, or what topic it would be on, because I feel like there's kind of a range of topics I could mm-hmm. do a podcast on. So when she mentioned that, I was like, perfect. Like, we all love true crime. So that sounds pretty.
So you already knew that you all loved true crime. Yes. Was it a thing in your family? Was it like a Sunday dinner conversation topic?
Yeah, I mean, we never really like, I can't really think of us ever sitting down as a whole family talking about true crime. So I don't think that ever happened, but for sure. I know we talked a lot about when there was a new Netflix documentary that would come out, we would talk a lot about it. Or Katie would mention this true crime show she was watching. And so we all knew that we were all super into it, but I don't think we knew how much into it we all were, I guess, until we started the podcast.
Okay.
So it's interesting. The three of us were all in different provinces. My one sister, she's on the East Coast. I'm in Toronto. And then my other sister's on the West Coast. So it's, yes, challenging to do a podcast virtually, especially with the time change. I always forget that Katie's 3 hours behind me. So I have to be mindful of that. So it's interesting when I see podcast hosts who actually record in person. I don't even know what that experience would be like because we've never done that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I record all of my podcasts online as well. And we're both in Toronto. We could literally be in the same room right now, but I didn't even mention that as a possibility. So you mentioned starting in January of 2021, and I did research for this episode, and I don't normally do a lot of research for my episodes unless they're my like special seasons on one topic. And I discovered that the interest for true crime really like peaked during the pandemic, which, you know, is it because there was something bad happening and people were looking for comfort? Or is it just because people had like more free time during the pandemic to listen to podcasts? But there's like a huge peak of interest for true crime stuff.
Yeah, it's probably because of Tiger King, that Netflix doc, because that was true crime. It came out right at the start of COVID. So people who might normally not be into true crime heard the buzz about it and were like, well, I'm home and I have free time, so let's try it. And then it hooked them in. I would say maybe there's a connection there, but also mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But yeah, true crime for sure in the last couple of years has really skyrocketed. There was always a community of true crime lovers, but not like what you see today.
So I did some research for this question, but I'm going to ask you first, why do you think people are fascinated by true crime?
It's a really interesting question. I don't even necessarily know if I know the answers to this, or I don't even
what
know.
What about yourself?
Yeah, I was trying to think. I can't even explain why I am into it for some reason. Like, to me, it's weird. It's really hard to explain why. I think part of it is maybe the mystery. Like, for the unsolved ones, for example, mm-hmm. those ones I find much more, I don't want to say more interesting, but I get a lot more into them or invested because it is unsolved and because there's the possibility of, you know, maybe there's going to be a break in the case, or maybe someone will listen to an episode of our show and maybe they'll, you know, somehow know someone who knows someone, you know. I think people love mysteries. People love, you know, the unknown. I feel like that's kind of a thing. So whenever you get a true crime documentary of something that's unsolved or people don't know, it's like they want to feel like they're involved. And I don't know if you aren't really into true crime. I don't know if you know the Gabby Petito case, which was from last year, which was like,
I have no idea. No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's like one of the probably most popular true crime cases ever. especially in the last 10 years for sure. But it was a woman in the States who, she was like a YouTube vlogger and she went missing. And so it was happening in real time. So there was a lot of these amateur sleuths who would post TikToks of like, I saw their car here. I saw the car here. So a lot of people kind of feel like they were helping to solve it in real time. And I think that's what was the draw to that case, is that you were seeing it unfold in real time. So people love to feel like they're involved. People love theorizing, hypothesizing. So for the unsolved ones, I feel that's kind of the draw. And I feel like you get that a lot more with a true crime story versus something that, you know, I'm not really into fictionalized. So like Law and Order or CSI or those kind of shows. Like, I'm not into crime that's fictionalized, which is weird. I like the true crime stuff. So I don't even know why, but maybe it is the unsolved aspect, the mystery, but also maybe just trying to figure out why people do the things that they do, which is something I'll probably never be able to understand, but feeling like maybe you can understand it is maybe a draw also.
Yeah. It's interesting. I didn't even put that in my notes, but I guess the interest for true crime is probably very different with social media and live tweeting. And are there like true crimes hashtag? I'm assuming there are.
Yeah, the Gabby Petito one is interesting because
they did have its own hashtag.
It did, yes. It was huge on social media. So I think, you know, TikTok and social media in general really helped that one get the attention that it got. There's probably a lot of other factors in there as well, but yeah.
It's really interesting because there's a part of me that's like, ooh, that's really interesting. I want to be involved. And the other part of me that's like, that's really creepy. That's really weird.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, I'm like, I love true crime. And sometimes I almost feel like I have to preface that with like, okay, I'm not weird or anything, but I love true crime. So I don't know. Even myself, maybe I think it's a little bit weird that someone loves true crime. Maybe there is something to that. I don't know.
So you said your love of true crime does not translate to crime solving TV shows that are fictional. Is it similar to like horror movies or like roller coasters or other things that scare us, or is it a different feeling?
I mean, I love watching horror movies. I don't enjoy the feeling of being scared. Like, to me, that's not a pleasant experience, but yet I seek out horror movies which cause that feeling, which is super weird. Or roller coasters. I don't enjoy the anxiety or the fear of being at the top of, you know, a super steep hill on a roller coaster, but I seek that experience, which is weird. So maybe for true crime, yeah, I know if I'm ever home alone or something and I'm watching a true crime doc at night, it creeps me out.
Okay.
And I don't enjoy that. I'm like scared, but yet I've done that to myself because I've watched this show. So I don't know. I think it's like, yeah, thrill seeking.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's definitely not the same thing. Like a horror movie with the music and everything, it's designed to be spooky or jumpy or gore. Whereas a podcast, it's more calm and talking and analyzing. And it's not my genre, but I don't know that there are true crimes podcasts that are designed to be like spooky or jumpy.
There has to be like probably 100,000 true crime podcasts out there. And obviously I haven't listened to even like 1% of them, but I have come across some that are much more with the creepy music, and some of them have like voice actors who reenact certain court transcripts or cell phone texts or stuff like that. So there is some that are like that. And then there's other ones where it's just the hosts discussing a case. So you kind of get a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I think one of the ones that I tried to listen to was one of the funny one. And I listened to the first episode. I was like, this is funny. And then the second episode, I was like, this feels weird. There's something a little bit off to me with like the comedic tone while talking about murders.
Yes, I can definitely agree with that. Those are definitely not my favorite. I don't really quite understand the draw of a show like that. They definitely make me feel kind of gross listening. So I don't listen or I don't follow them. I mean, no offense to anyone who likes those, but to me, like making light of something is not really my kind of vibe. So it's just interesting that there is sort of this subgenre of comedy true crime shows.
Yeah, the stories are quote unquote like easy to make funny. So it is funny. But also after a few episodes, I was like, I don't know that I want to listen to this all night.
Yeah. For me, I just always think of, you know, those are real people and they have real families. Yeah.
But it's so easy to forget.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, those comedic shows are super popular and obviously people love them and obviously the hosts do a great job, but I would just feel like as a host, if their loved one like being murdered or something, I would feel very off about making that a comedic experience. Yeah.
So I kind of looked online with my psychotherapist hat about what could make it fascinating for people. My show is about mental health, so I was like, okay, what does it do for people? And I found some things that was actually quite interesting, starting with the fact, I don't know if you know this fact, but there are some research or reviews that about 70% of people who listen to true crime media or podcasts are women. And then when I tried to search why all of the reasons that I found were very misogynistic and gross, and I was not satisfied with them, so I didn't write them down. I just decided that was ridiculous. The only thing that I found that was kind of interesting is that although more men die by homicide each year, that was from the US, like there are twice as many men who die as women. Women fear crime more than men. And I think maybe men homicide is a little bit, quote unquote, like easier to explain, where it's like drug cartel or guns or something illegal. Whereas maybe like women who are murdered, it's maybe a more like rich, interesting story. That might explain the fascination, the fact that women go through life with a higher fear than men of dying from murder, even though it's less likely according to stats.
Yeah, and I can tell you just from looking at our analytics that that holds up. 70% of our listeners are women. But yeah, I don't know why that is. Like, I'm not an expert. I can't explain why. It is just interesting that it's a genre that is very much women are drawn to true crime as a genre more than men are.
And like queer men are more fascinated, I think, than straight men.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's just interesting, like the numbers, but I don't really even know reasonings behind why. I'm interested to know, but I don't even know, because like I said, I feel like a lot of people can't articulate why they love true crime.
Yeah.
If you were to sit a true crime fan down and ask them, give me three reasons why you love true crime, I would guarantee you 80% of them could not tell you. It's just that people are drawn to it, and I don't know. It's weird. So
yeah. Well, I have reasons now. So maybe if you love true crime, you can listen to my reasons and maybe check the boxes. So the first kind of reason that I found is just that people are fascinated by storytelling and looking for something new. And there's a bit of like voyeurism of like dark curiosity. People are fascinated by like aberrant behaviors from other people, and they want to learn more. It does not really explain why. It's just one of the reasons why people are fascinated by it.
Yeah, voyeurism, like you said, people like to get a look into, I don't want to say the psyche of someone, but people are just drawn to people who commit crimes, maybe to understand why they do it. How could it have been prevented? What is the result of that? Could we learn anything from this experience? So I think maybe that's kind of the questions people like to ask themselves, maybe even subconsciously, but they don't even know that that's kind of what they're looking for, but it's kind of what people end up getting out of it.
That's sort of like the second reason, is that I think a lot of people like to try to understand the psychology behind violent crime. And I think that's really driven by media, where each time there's a killer, normally a white killer, the headlines are always going into, he was a lone wolf, he was radicalized by this, he was an awkward teenager. Like, they always try to explain white killers with mental health stuff, where I think it's just like poverty and capitalism, you know, like not just poverty, but like, I don't know how much crimes are explained by psychology, but in our media culture, people love to try to explain that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there is a lot of cases where, you know, money gets involved, you know, so maybe it is a level of people who have not a lot of money are drawn to the possibility of getting more of something they don't have. So I think, yeah, poverty could play into it. But you're right, you'll see a lot of on the news, whenever it's a white killer, all of these statements about they loved this, they were a quiet kid who loved like drawing or something, like irrelevant. And it's always like white men killers that get that. You never will see, if it's a killer of a different race, most likely you will not see a headline of they were an innocent quiet child. It'll be more of like much more negative spin, which is always interesting. But I think you're onto something too about not necessarily poverty, but people with lesser means. I think there is something to that also.
Yeah. Another reason we talked about it a little bit, but it's like the adrenaline rush, but from the safety of your own home, which I think is similar to loving horror movies or roller coasters. Like, I know that I'm safe, but I like making myself feel on edge. I think some people like that. I detest that. And I do not understand why people would go through that.
I mean, I just watched a true crime documentary last week that I was one of those people. I was on the edge of my seat. I felt very uncomfortable, very on edge the whole time. But when it was over, I was like, I wish there was another episode of this. Even though, you know, I can't say it's a pleasant experience to feel those emotions. But when it's over, it's like, no, I want more of that, which is very odd.
Well, there's often really good storytelling. Like, I watched a documentary on Anna Delvey, which was not really a documentary. It was like fiction. And I can't remember her name, the actress. She was so good. But she did such a good job at like creating like a character case that probably realistically did not look as much like the real Anna Delvey, but it's good storytelling. I think it's the kind of story that we as human, like diving into the coming of age and the understanding. Look at what Disney is doing right now with all like the pre-stories of the villains. Mm-hmm. We love those stories.
And also, I think it's always a draw, I feel, when you see a trailer for a movie, if it says based on a true story. I mean, people are drawn to, oh, this is based on something that's true, which might be a draw for people. It's funny because the show you're talking about is like Creating Anna. Was that the show that you watched?
Yeah.
It's funny because I watched a lot of true crime docs about her, but I've never actually watched the fictionalized version of that. And same with like the new Jeffrey Dahmer miniseries that's out there or whatever.
That has been a lot of backlash to it.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's a case or a story that I will say we will never cover on our show. Mm-hmm. It's gotten more than enough coverage. I don't really know why they're still telling that story after all these years. How many different versions of the same thing can you tell, for one, among other issues? But yeah, I won't watch the Jeffrey Dahmer one. So it's just interesting that you watched the Anna one that was like the fictionalized one, which is the one probably thing on her that I haven't seen.
It's the only thing on her that I
saw. Yeah.
There was also like talking about this. I was reading articles about like stop making killers or people who do crime so hot on media. Like, they always take actors that are significantly more attractive than the real person. And that's quite an interesting choice.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's Hollywood. They have to cast attractive people for you to watch it, which is the sad reality of Hollywood in general. But they always have, you know, like the gratuitous sex scenes. And it's just like, okay, this is not relevant. Yeah. I mean, maybe sometimes it's important to the story with certain cases or whatever. But, you know, more times than not, it's not necessary. So that's why I like the true stuff more, because you're seeing the actual people and you don't get all of that sort of Hollywood stuff. Maybe sometimes you do, like sometimes it is sensationalized even in the true crime stuff, but much less so, I think.
So another reason why people love true crime is that people find them soothing. And I think this is more of a me than something that I read, but I think it helps to take attention away from like larger systemic issues like capitalism and the 0.01% of the planet who's kind of like working us into the ground right now, and all of those issues. And then you can just focus on that like one crime, and normally it gets solved. So it's good storytelling. The villain gets punished in the end, and it's all wrapped up with a little bow on top. And it's very soothing for people to actually ingest problems that are solvable and have a happy ending, versus looking at what's happening right now in Iran or the war between Russia and Ukraine that's been going on for several months where we don't have any power over it. This is like a digestible amount of horror that normally has a happy ending.
Yeah, and maybe it's easier for people to watch because sometimes documentaries, they're about very heavy topics. I mean, true crime is too, but you know, you watch a documentary about the wars or 9/11 or all of these really, really heavy topics that aren't necessarily enjoyable to watch, even though they're important and you should watch them. But I think maybe the true crime offers a way to watch a documentary in a way that's maybe more scaled down. It's not talking about climate change and that we're all going to die tomorrow or whatever, you know? So yeah, maybe people find it less anxiety inducing.
Well, because in the true crime, the person who died is already dead and it's not me. So I feel safe in that sense versus climate change. The person who could potentially die could very much potentially be me.
Yes. Yeah. It's just like this like looming sense of doom over it at the end that you can't shake versus the true crime one where it's like, okay, this was completely removed from me and anything having to do with me. I can just sit and watch it.
Yeah. So again, with my therapy glasses on, I found that some people like the true crime shows because of a sense of comparison, like, oh, this would never happen to me. Or on the opposite, like, this could happen to me, so how can I protect myself from it? But I think the first one is more real, like that feeling blessed and guilty, knowing that, like, oh, this would not happen in my life. Or if it were me, I would have acted differently and this would have not happened to me, both feeling guilty, but also like that I have privilege feeling, I think really attracts people. And it's easy to put ourselves in a situation thinking like, oh, I would have never fall for this, or I would have reacted earlier, but who knows how we react when we're in the middle of something like that.
Yeah, because even on our show, we did a mini series on cults, and among every cult, you always have the thought of, why would you fall for this? This doesn't make any sense. Like, it's clearly a cult. How can you not see that?
When the story is told, like, from an exterior person with, like, prejudice on the cult, obviously it's a cult.
Yeah, exactly. And there's one story in particular. It was, like, very highly educated people, successful people who still can get sucked into it. So I guess the message was like, it can happen to you, even if you don't think it can. So that was interesting. But yeah, I think people always like critics, like, you know, from the comfort of their own house and sitting on their couch can criticize what someone else is doing. And oh, I would never do that. You know, I would have done this and this person is stupid for not doing this. And it's like, well, you know, sometimes you might act in a way that you wouldn't think you would if you were in an intense situation too. Right?
I wonder if it's similar to like me watching the Olympic, like the top of the like gymnast in the world, be like, oh, he fell at the end.
Yeah, everyone becomes an expert gymnast when they're watching the Olympics, as if they somehow themselves were an Olympic athlete in the past and know how to do that. Yeah. Oh, I can't believe they did that. Why would they screw this up?
I think it's really easy to judge other people, but I've seen, and my colleagues have seen, so many brilliant, really intelligent people stay in extremely toxic, manipulative, abusive relationship for a very long time. So there's a reason why people stay in those relationships, and it still brings something in their life. And it's easy from the outside, even sometimes as a therapist, to be like, leave. Like, obviously. But it's not always that easy when you're in the middle of it.
Yeah. And I mean, if it was as easy as just saying leave, then everyone would do that. So the fact that not everyone does, obviously, it's much more difficult. And like I mentioned before, we had a guest on who was talking about, you know, domestic violence and abusive relationships. And that was, you know, the one thing she was kind of running down, going through like the list of, you know, these are common reasons why I can't just get up and leave, like most people say. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I can have compassion. I definitely stayed too long in relationships that should have not even existed, maybe. But anyway, that's not the topic of this.
That's another episode.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the last reasons that I found, which is really close to therapy, is that with podcasts or true crime documentary, people get to hear about horror and horrifying things that people do, but then they get to hear people discuss. And even though in a podcast, you don't take active part in the conversation, you are a part of the conversation. So in therapy, we always say that things are always better when they're out and they're discussed. So I think you get to see the horror of a crime, of a homicide, but you don't just stay with it. You get the analyze, you get to discuss it, you get the host of the podcast talking about how it makes them feel to have seen that horror. So it is kind of therapeutic in a way.
Yeah. And everyone has a different perspective. Everyone has a different takeaway from a case. You know, if you watch a true crime documentary, that's why it's fun. Or I guess not fun. That's not a good word. But I guess it's interesting to talk with other people about true crime documentaries or true crime, because everyone has a different take on it. And you have a conversation with someone and you're like, oh, that's completely different. I would have thought of that, especially if it's like a theory about, you know, a missing person or something. So I think it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Finally, like really quickly, if you Google it, the first reason almost every website gives about why people love true crime podcast is to learn ways to defend himself. You don't see at home, but I'm putting like quotes over me, which I feel like is kind of the low hanging fruit of the reasons. And I'm not really into it. And I just feel like it's a cheap reason, but maybe I'm wrong because I literally don't listen to that. And then there was like one website that even said further that like, it's in the nature of human for like evolution purpose and evolution benefits to be always on the lookout for dangerous situations to make my survival greater, which I guess I believe in that. But I felt like this was kind of a stretch with listening to true crime documentaries.
Yeah, I think maybe there is some truth in there. You know, it's a horrible thing that happened because this situation. So maybe if that situation presents itself, like a similar situation to you, mm-hmm. you may have that in your mind or that perspective. So I could see that. But also, I mean, like I listen to a podcast. He says, oh, you should always write down your passwords to everything on this like secret thing so that if you go missing, people have your passwords to like look. And yes, that's a good idea in theory, but I don't know how many people actually do that. So, you know, while I say, oh yeah, maybe it's good to watch all these things so I can know what not to do, it's like, will I actually follow it in real life? I don't know.
Maybe. Do I even remember what is the password for my Instagram?
I do. I didn't put my Instagram password in, yeah, for years. It just is always there, right? It's always logged in. So I just think you can say like, oh, you can have all these lessons and you can do all that, but you don't know until you're in that situation. You know, people do weird things when they're under mm-hmm. stress in these intense situations that you can't really criticize until you're, I mean, there are some cases where it's like, clearly you should not do that and no one ever would, which is weird. But for the most part, it's like, you know, humans are weird just in general. Yeah. So you can't say I wouldn't do that until you've been in that kind of situation.
Yeah.
And in a perfect world, everyone would do the right thing 100% of the time, but it's not a perfect world. So that doesn't happen, right? And yeah, so.
So my last question on sort of like the meta of like true crime, you listen to, you research, you talk about crime, like homicide a lot. Does it affect your mental health? And are you and your sisters talking about how it affects your mental health?
I would say in the last season, so we finished season 3, you know, the end of June is when we finished recording everything for season 3. And the three of us, it was kind of an unspoken thing. The three of us were burnt out towards mm-hmm. the end of the third season. But I can't say that it was feeling burnt out from true crime itself. It was very time consuming. And, you know, everyone has stuff going on, like school and work and everything else and stuff. So the podcast was a lot of time commitment. So I think we were just burnt out from that perspective. So I think even if our podcast was about puppies and kittens, I think we still would have felt that. Yeah, I don't think it had to do with it. I mean, maybe the topic didn't help because it is quite dark, but it's hard to say that it was because of that. But I can definitely see, you know, it is very heavy. And some of the cases do get very intense, especially if you're listening to, you know, sometimes there'll be 911 tapes that we play. And so it can be very heavy, but I don't know. I think we were just burnt out in general. I can acknowledge it's a heavy topic, but I can't say that it affects my mental health. But maybe it is in a way that I'm not aware of.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because as a therapist, I hear a ton of really sad or intense stories. And it's not always that burns me out. I think it's tough as a therapist, maybe during the first year, but then it gets easier and we have outlets. We can, I guess you have your sisters that you can discuss like, oh my God, I was really heavy. This was like really dark. I like put an all nighter listening to 911 tapes and I feel off. And as therapists, we kind of have similar, it's not with my sisters, but we have like similar ways of getting support. So maybe it is kind of a similar thing where eventually it does not affect you quite as much.
Yeah. And one thing I can say is I actually felt having a guest on, definitely I felt that heaviness a lot more. Mm-hmm. Like when we were interviewing Jeffrey Deskovic, he was, you know, the one who was wrongfully convicted. The interview was so great. And actually towards the end of the interview, it actually had a really like hopeful message towards the end, which was good, but I did feel the heaviness. And after that interview, it just felt very heavy. And then again, when we had the guest on talking about like domestic violence and she was going through some of like her experience and all of that kind of stuff, it was very heavy. So I always found that guest episodes, I felt that a lot more. So maybe that's why we ended up not having as many guests on. Like, maybe that's like a subconscious reason. And I don't want to like say that having them on was like more overwhelming for us than their own experience, because obviously, you know, they're the ones who lived through it. But I just found myself, whenever we had guests on, like that, those were the times when I felt kind of consumed much more by it.
It's interesting. I wonder, I'm doing this reflection about myself out loud, if I don't really enjoy the genre because this is something I do at work. Like when I was working at Women's College Hospital in the trauma therapy program, all of our participants, everyone that was coming through the hospital, were people who had terrible horror stories in their childhood. They had survived them. So I wonder if, because I do that for a living, then I'm not interested in listening for that in a podcast.
Yeah, that's probably very true, especially if you're in a heavy field where you're dealing with that every day. I think it's important that you don't go home and consume that all night as well. You need to kind of have a break. So I think there is something to that.
Well, let's take a quick musical break and then we'll come back to talk about like mental health in the world of homicides and crimes. Welcome back. We're still with AJ and we're talking about true crimes and mental health, and I'm having a blast so far.
Yeah, it's a good conversation for sure. Like the questions that you asked were very like thought-provoking, which is good because it's kind of making me think of the true crime genre in maybe ways I didn't before.
Yeah, I mean, I love interviewing people, so thank you. First question, what do you know of the law and crimes and mental health? Like, because I went and researched laws about this for this podcast. It was very dense. But what do you know about it? Or what do you think the general opinion is regarding crime and mental health?
So in terms of, you know, a lot of the episodes that we do, we always have to preface it by being like, we aren't lawyers and we aren't mental health professionals. So this is just our opinion. I mean, I studied addiction and mental health like in school and stuff, but I'm not like a mental health professional by any means. Yeah. So I think when we're doing our episodes, we try to present the facts and we do have opinions. Obviously we talk about it, but we also have to come from it from a perspective of like, well, we aren't lawyers. So there's a lot of like legal stuff or even mental health stuff that if you're a professional, you would probably have more context for. It's not like a lawyer talking about the deep, you know, intricacies of the law and stuff like that. Obviously, we're informed. We research laws and like we know that, but you don't have the same perspective if you're actually a lawyer versus just somebody commenting on it. But I think the tie between true crime and mental health, I think it's easy and also kind of a cop-out. A lot of people will say, well, people who commit crimes or serial killers, well, they're just mentally ill. And it's like, well, that's A, not true, and also very like simplified, I feel. So when I'm covering a case, it's like sometimes it's part of the case or it's part of the facts of the case that, yes, this person was diagnosed with a mental illness, but also that doesn't
mean. Who isn't?
Yeah, exactly. And also it's like that doesn't mean, and I think that puts a lot of stigma on people who have mental illness because it's like most people with mental illness are not going to go and be a serial killer. Yeah. But I think a lot of times you see like in the media, it's like, well, this serial killer had this mental illness, and it's like, well, okay, but that's not an explanation necessarily. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
it's really interesting. While I researched, there were things that were just not mentioned anywhere that I am curious why they're not mentioned. And the first one, we were just talking about Anna Delvey. And for the most part, every true crime podcast talks about homicide and murder. And there's very few true crime documentary that was about like white collar crimes. Like there's not a lot of airtime about like this person that evades their taxes. It's all about gruesome murder. And I wonder why so much of the fixation is about that and not, and even with Anna Delvey, like the reason why people are so angry at her is because she was sort of middle class and then like dealt money at a higher level. But all of those higher level people who do crime probably very regularly, we don't talk about them. And that's not like an interesting genre. And there's nothing about them in the laws. It's all like homicide and murder stuff.
There used to be a show called American Greed, and it was kind of more white-collar crime. There was like insurance fraud or big executives stealing all these investors' money and stuff. And there's one case that was actually pretty well-known. Elizabeth Holmes, I don't know if you are familiar with that one, but she was like the CEO of Theranos, who ended up being a fraud, and her product didn't actually work. And her trial's happening right now. So I think there are certain cases that really do garner attention. But yeah, you're right. When you think of true crime, you don't think of that kind of crime.
Yeah. And I wonder if some of the fascination about what you're talking is due to the fact that she's a woman.
Yes, that's probably why. I mean, they just did a miniseries with Amanda Seyfried played her in the miniseries, which I also haven't seen because I don't really watch fictionalized versions of it. But yeah, 90% of the documentaries that are out there are about murder.
Right.
So you kind of have to, you know, you consume what is out there, right? Maybe it's like more relatable. People don't really care what the higher up people are doing in the office on Wall Street behind closed
doors. Maybe we should care.
Yeah, that's like probably what you should be caring about, because that's definitely much more, you know, has more repercussions, I feel. But people, I don't know, people can relate more, I guess, when it's, you know, Joe Schmo down the street who seems like a regular person. Maybe they feel like that's a more relatable, like, this could happen to me.
Yeah. You know? It's probably also, like I said before, more digestible as a crime. Like, there's a murderer, there's a victim, and that's it. Versus, like, all the white-collar stuff, it's, like, still ongoing, and it's not very tangible.
Well, and also, if it's a case about this billionaire who cons all these investors out, it's, like, it's hard to feel sympathy for a multimillionaire getting conned out of a couple of million dollars, right? Yeah. Like, it's, you don't really feel sympathy in the same way that you would for, you know, a regular person who's murdered, right? That's much more easy to feel sympathy over.
So in terms of the law, again, I'm not a lawyer, but according to the section 16 of the criminal code, you cannot be held responsible for an act that you committed or an omission that made people suffer if you have a mental disorder that renders the person incapable of appreciating the nature and quality of the act that they did, which is extremely vague. And if people really like go through this defense and they are held not responsible because they are quote unquote incapable of appreciating the nature of their act, people are not just acquitted. They go to another jury to say, like, what do we do with this person that has like a quote unquote mental disorder that is so high that they're committing a crime? And in the law, it's also presumed that nobody is suffering such a mental disorder and you have to prove it. So a little bit like how everybody is presumed innocent unless proved contrary. Everybody is presumed not mentally disordered. I don't love these words until proven in the court of law. So I thought this was kind of interesting.
Yeah. You know, it kind of comes up often, like the guy in Alberta a few years back, Vince Lee, I don't know, he was on the Greyhound bus and he decapitated somebody on the bus and stuff. Yeah, so it's a very heavy story, but that was a big thing. He ended up being found not criminally responsible. And I think that was, you know, back in 07 or something when it happened. And now he's like actually out on unsupervised visitations and stuff. So there was a lot of controversy in that. Like you said, you kind of go into the court proceedings from the perspective of like, you are criminally responsible unless you prove otherwise. Mm-hmm. And that's also hard of like where that line is. It's like, well, how do you prove it?
Yeah.
And sometimes it seems like it's very easy to prove it. And then other times, you know, people will try to go for that defense and then it gets denied. So I don't really know where the line is for that.
Yeah. From what I read, it looks very vague and it must depend on how good of a lawyer you have.
I mean, a good lawyer can spin anything, right? Yeah. Maybe in some cases it's just very easy. It's a more logical conclusion to come to. I don't know. But
in terms of like history in Canada, the first time that there was like the defense of quote unquote insanity, which is really not a word that I love, it was in 1843. And then the language around that defense is very gross. And so we're not going to name it on the podcast. And it stayed defense of insanity with that very old language that we would never use today until 1975, where somebody was like, maybe we should reform this. And it took 15 years until 1991 to have like clearer language. And they removed all of the gross language to use like mental disorder instead, which I feel like maybe should be revised again. But if it took like 125 years to be revised in the first place, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, because I mean, even terms from 1991, I'm sure, are not the terms we should be using today. I mean, I don't know, but I'm assuming that something from 1991 would not probably fly. But yeah, those cases always have controversy around them because, you know, you have those people that are saying like, no, they should be given the harshest penalty. And then you have the people who are much more like, you know, open to kind of having that defense or someone having that defense. So cases like that in Canada are always highly controversial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something else that I researched just because it's interesting. Do you remember last spring there was a lot of buzz regarding extreme intoxication and how somebody could get out of certain crimes by claiming extreme intoxication? And it was really mostly about rape and sexual abuse that people were really angry at extreme intoxication. Do you remember anything about that?
Yeah, I remember seeing articles and stuff about that when it came out, and it made me very annoyed and angry. So I didn't really look too much more into it because it just was making me mad. So yeah, unfortunately, I don't know like too much more about it. But yeah.
So I researched it. Again, extreme intoxication is pretty vague. There are not a lot of like things to define it, although it's absolutely certain that it needs to be alcohol plus drugs. Somebody could not be extremely intoxicated from only alcohol. So that's kind of interesting, I guess. And then it gets complicated because people obviously, well, quote unquote, obviously are not forced to take the alcohol and the drugs. So they do that voluntarily. So why would the action that they do after taking those drugs not be voluntary action, which is an interesting way to think of it. And in terms of murder, if you take that defense that you're extremely intoxicated and it passes, instead of being accused of murder, you would be charged with manslaughter, which is slightly different in our laws. Like murder has an intention and planning versus manslaughter is just like, I guess, killing someone. Don't quote me on that. Again, I'm not a lawyer. And manslaughter is just under murder. It's like the second worst thing that you can be charged with. So in that case, it makes sense in a way. But if I understand correctly, the problem with sexual assault is that if you claim extreme intoxication, instead of being charged for rape or sexual assault, you would be charged for inflicting harm or causing trauma. So it would not be sexual. And I think that's what like people were really angry at. And that's what I'm really angry at. It's really bad.
That just opens up a whole can of worms there. I don't know how someone would necessarily prove that extreme intoxication. Like you said, it has to be drugs and alcohol. Because I was going to say otherwise, I'm like, well, where's the line? So you can be intoxicated, but then what makes you extremely intoxicated? Like, that's weird.
They're saying that extreme intoxication is not being extremely drunk or extremely stoned. It's like an altogether different thing. And the word that they use is automatism. It's almost described as like an out-of-body experience, or you're doing things without realizing. So although it's called extreme intoxication, it's not about being extremely drunk or extremely high. It's really like a state where your mind seems to have completely disassociated. How it's proven, though, I don't know. And again, I'm not a lawyer. This is like from my research. So if I'm wrong, contact me and I'll do an erratum and I'll add it now.
Yeah, well, I think with the whole thing like you were saying about manslaughter, I guess I can kind of understand because manslaughter is, you know, I don't know if this is the right term or if I'm saying this correctly, but I think manslaughter, it's kind of seen as a crime of opportunity. Like it's not this well planned out thing. Mm-hmm. It's more of like somebody got into a fight with somebody and the other person ended up dead after the fight or whatever. It's like not like you didn't intend to kill them. I guess it goes back to intent.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it gets very murky. I don't know. Yeah. It's a very slippery slope, I feel. I mean, if you could just claim an extreme intoxication that it absolves you of anything ever, like that's...
It does not absolve people. Like, you do, no. You still get charged with stuff, but it's not...
Yeah. But it's a kind of like not an easy way out, but, you know, it is a way out for sure. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I just think it's very dangerous and it's a slippery slope. But again, I don't really know, like, I'm obviously not a lawyer, so I don't know the ins and outs of it.
Yeah.
So I can't really like speak too much on that. But I just know from like an outsider perspective looking in, like, this is a big, I don't know, sketchy.
Yeah. And it's hard to think that it would not be used to help mostly the rich and the powerful of this world.
Oh, I mean, yeah. When you were describing it, I'm like, I could like picture all the rich white guys who are probably going to use that in the future. So
yeah,
that's, yeah.
We're not going to go down that slope too far because we already have a lot of recording and we need to move on. But I have a note saying one thing is certain is that sending people to prison clearly does not help with mental health. So let's leave it at that, I guess.
Yeah. We could do a whole episode probably on the prison reform.
On the prison, yeah.
That's a whole, I mean, we've talked about that in our own, on our show, we've talked about that just as it comes up with cases and stuff, and especially with Jeff when we were talking to him. But yeah, that's a whole other episode. Yeah.
For sure. Which leads us to a question that I have for you. Like, what do you think of the myth that killers have more mental health issues?
Yeah, I think, like we kind of said a little bit before, you know, in the States, when you have a mass shooting, it's always like, well, they chalk it up to mental illness or whatever. Yeah. I just think it's like, yes, you have to consider that. Like, if somebody has a diagnosis of a mental illness and like they end up doing something, you kind of have to like, you have to factor that in. But I feel like it's kind of the low hanging fruit. Like, it's so the easy, I don't want to say easy, I don't know. It's the easy kind of way. And I think people come from a place of wanting to understand why people do things. And it's frustrating for people when it seems to be so random and, you know, somebody does a heinous thing and they can't track, you know, at some point in their life where something went wrong, and people feel like they need to know why something happened so that they can feel like they can prevent it. But honestly, like from my perspective, you can't really explain why people do the things they do. You know, humans are very, as I said a little bit before, very weird, very, I don't know. I just think mental health can like play into it in some ways because it's part of the story of like, well, they were diagnosed with this, but like, I never go into a case thinking like, well, this person must have had some mental illness or something. Cause I think just people are very like, they do weird things that you can't explain. And I think people don't like the frustrating nature of not being able to explain why people do certain things, you know?
And there are a lot of people with mental health issues that don't go around stealing and killing.
Yeah.
It's not like a direct correlation or causation.
Yeah. Like, you know, it might so happen that people fall into that category, but there's also other factors at play. Like, that's not, like I said, people want to feel like they know how things happen. So they also would simplify it. And as humans, we want to be satisfied and like feel like we know the answers to things. So sometimes you can't, like, sometimes people are just like weird and you can't explain why people do the things that they do. And I think that that's a truth that a lot of people don't want to accept. It's like, no, there has to be a reason. It's like, well, sometimes there just isn't.
Sometimes there. Yeah. So one of the things that's not discussed a lot when it comes to crime and murder, we discuss all the time the mental health of the killer, but never the mental health of the victims. So obviously, because people don't talk about it a lot, I researched it because I found that way more interesting. There is one research that talks about this that was made in Sweden from 2001 to 2008. And their conclusion-ish is that people with a mental health disorder were 5 times more likely to be a victim of a homicide than somebody without a mental health disorder. And they looked at like anxiety, depression, substance use, and personality disorder, which I want to point with a grain of salt that the results show that people who have a substance use disorder, which like we need to put a pin on that to discuss that later, were actually 9.5 times more likely to be the victim of a homicide. And whereas like the other things like anxiety and depression and schizophrenia were very much like a lower rate, it's just that because substance use is 9.5 times more likely, it makes the research say like people with mental health disorder are 5 times more likely to be victim. And I'm always very careful around substance use because there's so much stigma around it. And it's so easy to sort of like just say like, oh, it's substance use that like make people get murdered or get killed. And I know that substance use or alcohol is very much often present in homicides. But also this research, I haven't read the whole research. I kind of like skim through, but like a lot of people with severe mental health issues or not even severe tend to use drugs and alcohol more. So it's kind of like murky as well. And I talked about this earlier, like, although it does seem to be mental health itself that increases the rate, in my head, it's like life circumstances and social determinants of health, aka like just poverty. I think it is well known that people with more mental health issues or substance use issues tend to have less money. And then I'm just assuming that like living in poverty is a big factor for being the victim of a crime or not.
Yeah. And those are interesting stats. And it's hard to, I mean, yeah, with numbers that staggering, it's like, yeah. Well, obviously there's, you know, look into that because there's something there. But also I don't, yeah.
But what about like people who use drugs and alcohol but don't have a mental health disorder or diagnosis of anything else? Are they also more likely? It's really unclear.
Yeah, it's very, very murky. And yeah. I think, and you know, I feel like it's so hard to like unpack. It's so, yeah. There's so many factors right at play. And yeah. And like you said, social determinants of health and like goes back to poverty. And I think like poverty creates so many issues, like it's like a snowball, right? And I think like being a victim of a crime is just like one of the many ways in which poverty can snowball into something.
And like, which is the chicken and which is the egg? Like, are people living in poverty because they use drugs, or people use drugs because they live in poverty and life is harsh? Like, we don't know, and our systems are so broken. And I'm a big fan of decriminalization and legalization of drugs, and I would, in my head, it would solve so many problems, because that study was like some of the ways that could help people be less victims of crime is like treatment for substance use, which is such like a magic wand kind of idea. Like, oh yeah, we'll send people to treatment. Great. And then the other two were like stable employment or income and like stable housing. And I was like, yeah, yeah. A living wage and stable housing will absolutely reduce the like level of crimes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, like, it seems so basic. And and also, I think, like, if someone is a victim of a crime and it's like, oh, well, they were using substances or they had mental illness, it's like, okay, but a lot of people who commit crimes prey on people who have those issues, right? So it's like kind of like a chicken or the egg. It's like, okay, well, were they a victim of a crime because the killer was like, okay, well, this is a prime opportunity because this person is more at risk? It's just, it's so murky. I don't know. It's like, it's really hard to kind of separate because so many things can impact other things. I don't know. It's just, it's harsh out there.
There's also this myth that you mentioned in mental health that like people who are abusers or toxic tend to prey on people with lower self-esteem, which I think is not true. I think people who are abusers or toxic just like attack everyone or like try to abuse everyone, and just people with higher self-esteem or better boundaries are just better at like putting them away right away, so they don't spend too much energy on those people. But people don't choose, like, there's also like there's a little victim blaming of like, oh, it's because of my past I attract abusers, and like no, like abusers just abuse everyone. And you're not, I'm sorry, you're not special.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, someone who's going to commit a violent crime, they don't discriminate, so to say. You know, like, they will, anyone that they can get to, you know, steal from or whatever, they're gonna like do. So yeah, I guess, like you said, people with more boundaries or higher self-esteem, they're able to kind of thwart that effort.
Yeah, like cut toxic people out of their life.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
In your podcast, how do you discuss mental health without like victim blaming or without increasing stigma?
Yeah, that's like a very fine line. I feel like a lot of podcasts cross the line in that way. I think when I'm presenting a case, context is important. Like, you know, sometimes if we have a background on the victim, we'll like talk about how they grew up or like what their circumstances were, but never in a way to explain, like never in a way to make it seem like, well, this is their fault because of this. It's more of like, well, no, these are the circumstances that allowed, like maybe put them into contact with this person. But
yeah, I keep thinking about substance use, and there's just so much stigma around it that it would be really hard to talk about substance use in a neutral way in a homicide case.
Yeah. So people are like, well, yeah, this person ended up, you know, they fell into using drugs, and then they ended up in this situation.
Fell into using drugs. Oh
yeah.
My God.
Yeah. Like, you know, that's what people always will say. Like, oh, they just like, you know, whatever. They ended up, and it's like, okay, yes. Like I was saying, I will explain somebody's circumstances to know like who the victim was and like what their life circumstances was. But I do try very hard not to, you know, if they didn't just put themselves in that situation, that wouldn't have happened. Like, I try not to do that, obviously, because it's victim blaming, and I try to stay away from that. But like, I hear a lot of true crime shows where it's like, well, just don't do drugs. And that's, yeah, you know, like, that's the takeaway of the show. It's like, don't do drugs, people. Like, okay. But yeah, it's just like, whatever. So I try to like come from it from a very fair and empathetic perspective.
As if like people are not using drugs for a reason. Like, it's such a simple way of thinking to say like, oh, if your problems come from drugs, then just stop using the drugs and you won't have problems. But like, that is not how it happens. And if you want to learn more about that, have a whole series on addiction.
Oh yeah. And like, also I feel like too, it's like, well, it's kind of the other way around. It's like, well, no, drug use is kind of like a result of other past trauma. It's not the other way around that.
Yeah. And then like, obviously sometimes for a lot of people, using drugs create more trauma and then creates more poverty and creates more problems, but it's sort of like a circle and we don't know where it begins.
Yeah.
So my podcast, Mental Health Much, is about mental health and queerness, and we haven't talked about any queer stuff. So what is the place of queer in the true crime world?
Yeah, it's interesting because every season we try to do a mini series on like a certain topic. So one year it was missing and murdered Indigenous women, and then last season it was cults. So we were kind of discussing, well, are we going to do serial killers or whatever? And like, of course, the Bruce MacArthur case came up, which of course there's a whole book on, you know, the queer community in Toronto and like kind of their reaction to how this thing went on so long because it was the queer community. So I think, I mean, everyone knows, or many people know at this point, that like, the queer community is marginalized, and therefore victims who are part of that community are not given as much coverage or attention.
Right. That's interesting. They're not only given less support, but also less coverage and attention.
Yeah. And again, I'm not like an expert. I didn't do like a scientific study to have like exact numbers, but I think it's like pretty like well known that that is a very real issue. And we saw it up front and center with the Bruce MacArthur case in Toronto. And I just think the whole attitude of the police and the general public, there was a lot of also like racism that went into that as well, because they were immigrants and they were like, you know, so there was a lot of that. And when it was a white man that went missing, then all of a sudden the police got involved. So there was a lot of many factors at play.
Yeah, there were so many levels. Like, a lot of his victims seem to have been like queer men of color. Some of them were like street involved. Some of them were involved with drugs. So like, so many layers of, oh, there's like a gay brown man who's homeless and uses drug that disappeared. Like,
yeah,
I'm not going to open a case for that.
Yeah. Like, they were probably just like, add them to the list of all the other, you know, like there was no thought put into it. And then Andrew Kinsman was the missing man who then, it was like his family put all the attention, and then the police finally started to look into it more, and then obviously resulted in, sorry, I'm spoiling this case for anyone who's going to listen to it on potentially on my show, but most people, I feel like a lot of people know about that case.
Yeah.
So there were so many like intersecting factors in that case, and one of that was queerness. And I just think anyone who does their research into the police's relationship with the queer community will, I mean, that tells you kind of pretty much everything you need to know. When there are cases of like murders that happen in the queer community or missing people from the queer community, I think it's important to really focus on those stories and elevate those stories, because those are the ones that you're not going to probably see on the evening news. So I think it's important to kind of give more attention to those kind of cases and like marginalized groups in general. But I think the queer community for sure.
Well, there's this whole idea of like hate crimes towards homosexuality, which either is not covered in the news as much anymore or happens less than maybe it did in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. But we were talking about mental health and substance use. And like, this is one thing that we know, that like growing up from a marginalized community like the queer community, queer people tend to have higher rates of substance use or alcohol consumptions and higher rates of mental health disorder. So maybe we are a little bit more at risk, plus just the hate crimes.
Mm-hmm. again, I think like if someone's queer, then they use that as a reason of like, well, they put themselves in all of these high risk environments and we're doing all these high risk activities, which is like total, obviously BS, right? And it's just a way to marginalize the community even more. But I don't really quite know like at what, how far or like how much improvement has actually happened from the Bruce McCarthy. Like if that same thing were to happen now, like would the police react differently? Would the media cover it differently? Like, I can't feel confident in saying that it would be any different.
Yeah, totally. But
maybe I'm just being pessimistic. Like maybe I would hope that it would because what we've learned from the Bruce MacArthur thing, but I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, one thing that is sure with our communities, with the queer community, is that we have learned a long time ago to take care of our own and not expect the government and the higher power to take care of us. And in a way that's beautiful and in a way that's really annoying.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It can be a really like positive, beautiful thing, but also it shouldn't have to be that because the law enforcement should just step in any way that they would for any other community.
Yeah, it should also be reformed.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another episode also. It's like, yeah.
So, Andrew, we're almost at the end of the show, but I wanted to ask you, do you think there is a potential killer in all of us?
Wow, that's dark.
Ending on a light note.
Yeah. I don't know. If I said yes, like, that makes me super pessimistic and, like, I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think there is.
That's fair. I don't think so either.
Yeah. Like, I think, like, so is that to say that, like, everyone is capable of doing it and it's, like, certain people's circumstances that push them to doing it? But, like, I'm not going to say that. Because if I said that, then that would be saying that I feel like I'm capable of killing someone, which is, like, not true. So I feel like, no, it's not in everyone because I could never do that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like most people I know could not do that. But then you always hear these stories of people who are like, I would never have expected this from this person. Like, you know, all these stories and like it seems to come out of nowhere and they don't seem to have any of the quote unquote like risk factors for someone who would do that. So in those cases, it's kind of weird, but also you never really quite know what's going on in someone's life. That's why those true crime shows where they're always like, I never knew this, or it looked like the perfect marriage, or it looked like this. It's like, well, you don't know. Like no one from the outside knows the dynamics inside someone else's relationship. So my answer is no, there is not a killer in all of us.
Great.
Yeah. To put it simply, no.
One thing that there seems to be in all of us, though, is that sort of like fascination for the dark side of humans. And we could do a whole episode on this, but there's really something interesting in like dark tourism or crime tourism and like how people, when there's a true crime case that's really like high profile, a lot of people go and visit that and it's really like disrupting. And I don't know any of those people, but I read online that Ken Kratz, the prosecutor who helped put Avery behind bars for the murder of Teresa Halbach, I had to read all of that because it doesn't mean anything to me, but this prosecutor has had over like 4,000 death threats since there was a show about it. And since the show aired, like this person received a ton of death threats and like has kind of like ruined his life. And that's really intense.
Yeah. Like making a murderer. I mean, I know you're not into true crime, but that is a riveting documentary. It has 2 seasons. It's very heavy. As soon as you said the name Stephen Avery, I'm like, I know all about this case. I've gone down the rabbit hole of this case. But yeah, people also get super invested and I think from the outside, like, we don't know. So when a lawyer comes up or when something like in the law happens and maybe you don't understand it or maybe it seems frustrating, it's like, well, we just don't know the intricacies of all of that. So I think people become armchair experts and think that they know. So for them to like send death threats, I don't know. It's just...
Yeah, it's very...
It's very...
Yeah.
I mean...
I don't even have a word. We both didn't finish that sentence.
Yeah. It's just very, I don't know. I feel like there's so many, like, people just are so bold. Yeah. It will just like, you know, anonymously send a death threat to someone. Like, it's no big deal. Like, it's just a Tuesday. I'm going to send a death threat to someone. Mm-hmm. Like,
maybe there is a killer in all of us.
Yeah. I mean, well, apparently the death threats that people get, you know, seems to be a killer in everyone, apparently. Yeah. Or a lot of people. But yeah, I love the true crime community, but also I feel like every community has, you know, the outliers that you just like, don't be sending death threats to people. Come on.
True.
That's the message of the episode. If there was one.
That's a really nice way to finish. Don't send death threats to people. But is there anything that you want to say in conclusion? Something we have not talked about, or maybe like a few tips for people who engage with true crime and how they can make sure that they maintain their mental health?
Yeah, that's a good way to close it off. I think just remember that these are true people, real people, mm-hmm. with real families. You know, the families have gone through trauma. And I think a big important thing is to try not to re-traumatize folks. And I think that was one of the biggest controversies with the Jeffrey Dahmer series that mm-hmm. came out, was that the family even spoke out saying that basically re-traumatized them all over again, having to see this fictionalized version. So I think just being mindful when you're consuming it, or if you maybe host a true crime show or do something in the true crime realm, like just remember that these are real people, real stories, and that it can have an impact. Like your words have impact. So be mindful of that and come from it as a place of like being sympathetic and empathetic and like wanting to maybe add something to the conversation mm-hmm. that's more than just, well, I'm going to tell this really interesting story because I'm going to sensationalize it, you know? So that's one. And then also two is like, it's okay to take a step back from it for your own mental health, your self-care. Like it can be very heavy and it can impact you, you know? It's like heavy talk, like when watching documentaries about murder and evil things, and it's not like light viewing by any means. So it's okay to, you know, remove yourself from, don't overwhelm yourself with it. Maybe watch one true crime doc a month. And then you can get invested and then maybe walk away and then come back to another one later. Like you don't have to watch one first day it comes out on Netflix. Like be kind to yourself.
Watch it with a friend. Listen with a friend. And yes. You have someone to talk about it with.
Yes. And it's okay. Like listen to half the episode and then stop and then come back to it. Or listen to one episode at a time. You don't have to binge. I know for me, some nights we'll like record 3 back-to-back episodes.
Oh my god.
Like sometimes we'll like get behind and we'll go a few weeks without recording, so we're like, no, we have to make up for it, so we'll do like 3 in one night, and that's heavy for me. So don't do that if you're a podcaster. Don't do 3 in one night. Try to stick to one. And if you listen to true crime podcasts, like just one episode at a time.
It makes me think, it has nothing to do with true crime, I mean kind of, but I discovered a really amazing podcast on QAnon, and I binge listened to it, I think, in over like 3 days.
Oh my gosh. What was that podcast? I need to listen to this.
It was in French. It was called Faisez vos recherches, and it was really good. It was really well done. It won like a ton of prizes in Quebec, and I listened to all in like 3 days. And then for like the next few days, like every time somebody was saying anything, I was like, do you know that QAnon this? Do you know that QAnon that?
Yeah, well, it's actually interesting that you mentioned that, because I actually talked about QAnon on my show one time, because we were talking about cults. So yeah. We were doing our cult miniseries, QAnon. Yeah, that's a whole also in that whole episode.
Anyway, in conclusion, don't send dead threats to people mm-hmm. and take care of yourself. And it is Halloween season. It is queer holiday right now. It's the spooky season. So go and listen to Crime Family Podcast. Where can people find you, AJ?
Yes, we're on all the podcast streaming platforms. So Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all that. So we're at Crime Family. So just type in Crime Family, you'll find us. And if you want to follow us on social media, we're at Crime Family Podcast on Instagram. Our Twitter is Crime Family Pod 1, and then our Facebook is just Crime Family Podcast. We also just launched our Patreon page, so we're very excited for that. So if you follow us on social media, you'll get the link for our Patreon. We also have it on all of our episode show notes, so if you want to support the show and get extra content, then definitely do that, because we'd love to have you.
Yeah. They record 3 episodes a night for you. So yeah. I don't know what else I need to say about dedication to this podcast.
Yeah, lots of dedication. So we're trying to step away from the three episodes a night, but you know, we'll do anything for the patrons, whatever they want.
Well, thank you so much for coming on my show and talk about true crime for almost 2 hours. This is going to be a very long episode.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't know what his time limit is for an episode, but I feel like we've gone over.
We did. Yes, absolutely. So,
yeah. Yeah, but it was a good conversation. It was fun to chat with you about a topic you don't quite know too much about. I love getting more people in, more into the world of true crime. So,
yes.
I mean, I don't know if you will be after this. You might never listen to true crime again, but, you know, at least you know a little bit more about maybe why people like
it. Yeah, it was really interesting. I think I love the meta conversation about it more than I will ever love listening to it. But this was really fun.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was fun.
Of course. And thank you, obviously, everyone, for listening. You can find me on Instagram at mentalhealthmuch. Don't hesitate to give me a rating or a review. And until next time, keep talking about mental health as much as you can. And stay safe.
Bye.